Visit Wales are proud to sponsor the RHS Gardening Podcast. To find out more about Wales's beautiful and historic gardens, go to visitwales.com/gardens.
Hello and welcome back to the RHS Gardening Podcast, sponsored by Visit Wales. Every fortnight, we bring you a mixture of features and discussions exploring every aspect of gardening: plant care, garden design, pest control, container ideas, and growing your own fruit and vegetables. Plus, expert seasonal advice on what you should be doing in your garden right now. I'm Sian Thomas, Garden Visits Editor of the RHS Monthly Magazine for Members, The Garden. Coming up in this June edition, the latest news on RHS summer events across the UK, our RHS advice team tackles your seasonal gardening problems, and an expert guide to creating colour-themed borders to suit any garden. But first, let's go outside to see what the horticultural teams at RHS Garden Wisley in Surrey have been working on this month.
My name is Matthew Pottage and I'm Garden Manager at RHS Garden Wisley. So it's a time of year now when everything is kicking into life. We can see loads of activity of spring perennials, of summer perennials. But just looking around us now, the thing that catches my eye, which is looking a bit tatty, are all the remains of the spring bulbs. And people often ask, you know, what on earth can you do? When can you cut back foliage? Everyone's always desperate to clear away the remnants of bulbs. And rightly so, you know, they don't really add anything this time of year. One of my favourite tricks is if the bulbs are dying down, the leaves have laid down, they do take a while to take those nutrients back to the bulbs. You can just mulch over them. You can obviously plant something that's going to grow over the top of them as a succession. So something like big, broad hosta leaves nicely cover spring bulbs under trees. But if the leaves are yellowing, they're browning, and with a gentle tug they pull away, then it's totally fine just to get in there, rake them off, pull them out by hand, and that's absolutely fine. But in contrast to those narcissus, which really have died back, the chamassias over here, the chamassia, it's a big, tall, blue flowering bulb. They're like moist sites. They're really good naturalized in grass, but they're just as good in a herbaceous border or a mixed border. But they are a bit later to flower, and you can see there's still a lot of greenery on those leaves. We wouldn't want to be going in there pulling those off. You're robbing that bulb of an energy resource, which is still in the foliage. The plant is still very active. That's going to need probably another 3-4 weeks till that foliage has completely died down. And kind of in halfway house between the narcissus, which are sleeping now, the chamassia, which are still very green, you've got the bluebells. And bluebells are a funny one because those seed heads stand up tall and proud, great big seed capsules on them, and they can look a mess again, and they do get around. They're very, very vigorous things. And to be honest, at Wisley, we find bluebells a bit of a nuisance when they pop up in ornamental borders. They're great in a woodland, they're great in grass under trees, and if you've got bluebells you don't want, they're fine to lift still in the green, put them into turf, put them under trees. They're very, very vigorous. The Spanish bluebell, which is much larger, a paler flower head, holds its flower upright, are tremendously vigorous, almost to the point of being invasive. So if you don't want any more of them, pull those seed heads off now. It's very satisfying. They come off clean at the bulb, and get them off before they set seed everywhere. Or if you want them elsewhere in your garden, you know, you can collect those seeds and sprinkle them through grassland or through shade under trees. But with bluebells, you're not going to do a lot of damage pulling off those seed heads. Again, if you're just going to treat them politely, let the leaves start to brown off before you remove them. But you are fine to take a border fork to them and lift the bulbs if they're in the wrong place. You'll be amazed how quickly they recolonize and how quick they spread. They are really quite a successful bulb. But, you know, as we saw a few weeks ago, they are beautiful when they're en masse, when they're in full flower.
Hello, it's Andrew Salisbury here, senior entomologist at Wisley. Throughout spring and early summer, an awful lot of plants can become infested with greenfly, blackfly and other aphids. I mean, there are about 500 species of aphids in the UK and they can infest almost any plant. These colonies can build up very quickly in the late spring and early summer, so much so that they can suck the life out of plants. There are a number of control methods that you can use. You can spray with insecticides, either organic or the synthetic types, or you can try manual removal, basically squashing them between finger and thumb. If you are going to treat food plants, do make sure that the food plant is listed on the label and make sure you follow the instructions for that food plant. And in many cases where the green fly and black fly are exposed on the plants, it may be better to go for one of the organic types of spray. Basically, this is because it will affect the natural enemies less. And as you go through the season, these natural enemies, such as lacewing larvae, ladybirds, hoverfly larvae, do actually keep aphid numbers in check, which is why, as you go through the season into midsummer, green fly and black fly tend to be less of a problem.
You can find more gardening tips and guides to seasonal jobs in the garden on the RHS website, rhs.org.uk/gardening. As regular listeners will know, once a month on the RHS Gardening Podcast, members of our advisory team answer your gardening questions from around the UK. Tackling the queries this month are Jenny Bowden, Rob Sterling and Guy Barter.
I'm Jenny Bowden and I'm a horticultural advisor for the RHS and I work at Wisley.
I'm Guy Barter, I work with the advice team at Wisley.
And my name's Rob Sterling and I'm also one of the advisors here at Wisley. The next email is from Sally Byers and she asks, are there any suggestions for what I could put in a window box on a dorm or balcony? Exposed to the wind, sun and rain, and I often forget to water.
Well, I think the watering bit is something you may actually have to do. So we break the question down into sections. And the last bit, and I often forget to water, well, you really do need to water. Obviously, water-retaining granules in the window box, in the compost, can help. But if it's to be a permanent fixture, then obviously you don't really want water-retaining granules in the winter time, because things could get waterlogged. You're just getting far too much water then. Water retaining granules can work well for summer bedding, so she could consider planting pelargoniums, for example, which have very, very low requirements for water. In fact, they probably wouldn't even need the water retaining granules. So they're normally planted once the frosts are over, and they're the scented leaf, they have an oil in them which makes them kind of scented. The zonal pelargoniums, shrubby, very bright colours, pinks, whites, reds. They would probably do quite well in this situation.
And for winter, think about heathers. These are plants that are adapted to grow in windswept open heaths, lands and moorlands. So they don't mind the wind and the cold and the rain and a bit of sun if you're lucky enough to get some in the winter. And quite possibly in the winter, it'll rain enough so that your tendency to forget to water won't matter so much. However, be aware that if it freezes solid, these plants can desiccate. So you might want to retrieve your window box if it's a really long freezing spell and keep it somewhere where it's not going to freeze solid. I wouldn't be too worried about the water retaining gels. They don't make a great deal of difference. They'll help, but not a great deal of difference. But you've really got to find a way to remember to water. You could try programming your phone to remind you. That sounds like a modern way of doing it.
Possibly another alternative for summer planting would be some of the hardy succulents. They would certainly be happy in a sunny spot. They would like quite an exposed spot too in terms of the wind, because they don't like closed environments because they're sensitive to rotting. And they would also forgive you for not watering them too often.
Unfortunately, not everyone's lawn is a lovely uniform green. And one of the commonest questions that the RHS Members Advisory Service gets asked, especially in summer, are issues to do with lawn patches. And in this instance, Kate, Jane and Robert have all got issues with their lawns. Kate wants to know how she can grow a lawn without patches, and Jane says there's bold spots, which I think she means bright green areas, and then other areas that are less green. And finally, Robert has patches caused by dog urine on the lawn, and they all want to know is how they can end up with a more uniform green sward.
Well, certainly in the case of the dog urine on the lawn, that needs to be treated immediately in order to stop the lawn from going brown. So if you let your dog out on the lawn to pass urine, then forearmed with a bucket of water to actually slosh onto the area of lawn where they've relieved themselves. That will dilute the urine and stop the chemical in the urine from burning the lawn.
Some people report that there's materials that you can buy to feed your dog that'll make the urine less toxic to the grass, but there's no evidence that we're aware of how well these things work. But assuming that your vet doesn't say otherwise, it would be worth trying.
And if the problem's really bad, then you may need to reseed. If you haven't been out there fairly swiftly, as Rob says, then reseeding may be an option there, as it is for some of these other situations. Jane talks about a patchy with bald spots, which we're interpreting as
it could be bald spots,
couldn't it? So yes, the end result is exactly the same, isn't it? Sort of bald patches, which you may need to reseed, which isn't always that easy.
I think you have to also investigate why areas might be bald or bare or whatever they are. One of the easiest ways of doing this is to take your fork and just push the fork into the ground for 6-8 inches and see if there's any resistance, and compare that with the resistance in areas where the grass is growing well. If there is resistance, it would suggest the soil is compacted and you might need to loosen it by digging the fork in every foot to the depth of 6 inches and gently levering it back a bit to open the soil up, and then after that follow with reseeding. In the autumn, it's worth doing what's called overseeding, where you apply lawn seed at half the recommended rate over the entire lawn after raking the lawn. So first of all, you rake the lawn, remove any moss and thatch, spread the grass seed and then rake that in. And in the cool, warm, moist weather of autumn, the grass can grow and thicken up the whole sward and make it more resistant to patches in future. If the soil isn't compacted, consider if the grass is dying in the wet areas of your lawn. So during the winter and after rainstorms in the summer, see if the water lies where the patches are. If it does, you may need to push the fork in as deep as feasible to let the water drain away, and you'll have less wet patches. Another cause is that insects, larvae, feed on the patches, typically leather jackets. And the sign of this is when birds peck the lawn and trying to get at these larvae, and treating in the autumn with nematodes can kill the insect larvae in a biologically controlled sort of way, and that can reduce the problem as well.
One other thing that you may have in your lawn is uneven ground levels. So if the soil is undulating, or the lawn is undulating, for example, then when you're mowing the lawn, the higher areas, the higher levels or hillocks tend to sort of be scalped by the lawnmower much more readily than the lower lying areas of the lawn. And in doing so, because the grass is cut too short, it weakens it and sometimes kills it out. So that is something that could be remedied by in the autumn or in the early spring, taking up the turf and levelling the soil and then replacing the turf so that the ground is level again.
It's also worth pointing out that grass needs at least a good half a day of sunshine in order to flourish. And so if you've got hard wear going on the lawn, if there are children running all over it, etc., and you've also got a lot of shade, then you are going to get bald patches. Which leads on to our next question. Amy Goggins from Keswick says, have you got any good ideas for an area of the garden that is completely shaded by trees from other gardens? It used to be a lawn, but she says that she'll probably have to give up the idea of having a lawn there. So she's realised that shade and lawns do not go together and is looking for some alternatives, which is a very good move, and there are various ways you can deal with that. You can turn it into a shrubbery. There are lots of plants that will tolerate shade, but they tend to be things that flower before the canopy would come out, because they'd be woodland orientated plants, and so in their native environment they'd come out before the trees leaf out in a deciduous woodland. So you can have a real splash of colour from bulbs and from things like woodruff and hellebores, and obviously ferns for the foliage. There's a whole range of things, dicentra, epimediums. There's there's many, many plants you can use. Bleeding hearts are one of the plants that flower early in the season. Brunnera is a plant which has little tiny forget-me-not blue flowers, and it's got heart-shaped leaves, so you've got really good ground cover as well. Some of the geraniums are good for early summer, not the ones that you buy as bedding, the ones with the aromatic leaves and the bright red flowers. Hardy geraniums tend to have white, pink and violet flowers, and they're perennial, so there's no need to replace them each year. And some of those are very good in shade. There's one called Geranium macrorhizum, which covers the ground very well, so there won't be any problems with weeds. If Amy finds that weeds don't grow there, then there's more of a problem generally with growing anything. So if the weeds don't grow, then it is going to be worthwhile to thin the canopy so that more light does come in, and then you've at least got some chance. Dicentra, its common name is bleeding hearts, and I think it's called ladies in the bath. There's another name for it. And it's got beautiful filigreed foliage and pinkish flowers. There's a variety called Valentine as well, which has got red and white flowers, and it's absolutely beautiful, and it does well in part shade. And Woodruff, it covers the ground very, very well, especially in dry soils, and it's common name is its Latin name is Galium, but its common name is Woodruff, and it is related to sticky buds. Some people call it's a weed, but Galium might be Woodruff may be considered a weed if you haven't got enough space for it. But it's got little white flowers. It's called Lady's Bedstraw, I think. It's got little white flowers, and it travels. And it will suppress weeds, so it's a good one in a reasonable space.
And it was used in the old days. When the foliage is dry, it smells of sweetly mown hay. So in the old days, they used to dry the leaves and use it to scent linen. So it has quite a sort of history, practical history as well.
But there are shrubs that will grow in shade as well, aren't there? So it's quite a range, including scented things.
Yes, I mean, something that some of the smaller shrubs, for example, would be Daphne laureola, which is our native Daphne. It's an evergreen, low-growing shrub with glossy green leaves and lime green flowers. And these have a really sweet scent at night if you're out in the area. Another one to consider would be Mahonia aquifolium, which has a sort of a holly-shaped leaf and quite spiny, although soft. And the flowers are, if you look at them very closely, they're in a big cluster, but if you look at them very closely, they're like tiny, tiny narcissus flowers. They're sort of little cup centre with petals around them, but very, very small.
Scent is amazing.
And they're very, very strongly scented. And another one to consider for scent underneath tree, another evergreen, is Sarca cocca hookeriana, which flowers in January, February. It's called sweet box because the leaves look similar to box, and in fact it is related to the box in the box family. But the flowers smell amazingly, and they hang on the air. So the next one is from Rachel Summers, and she writes, "My garden is turning into a thistle patch. What do I do apart from keep grubbing them out?"
Thistles are usually the perennial thistles, which have got roots that run below ground. So every time you cut them up, they come again. However, they're not immortal. And if you cut them, or even better, pull them with gloved hand, you wear them down. So as soon as they're a foot high or so, winkle them out and keep wearing them down. And after a year or two, they'll be gone. You can speed the process up a bit in uncropped ground by treating them with a glyphosate-based weed killer that'll be taken down and killing some of the roots. If you're lucky enough to have enough room to allow some of the thistles to grow unchecked and flower, they're extremely good for wildlife and biodiversity. But of course, that's not an option in a small garden.
We had a question from C. Smith, who's in Carlisle, who says, "My rhubarb flowered despite only being planted last year. He pulled the flower stalk off, and he would like to know, will it now make some more edible stems? Fingers crossed." I think the news is quite good on that one, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, the fact that it's flowering wouldn't prevent it from producing new leaves, but Which can be harvested, but not a good idea to harvest the leaves in this year after the plant has flowered. Normally, the plants flower, particularly during wet summers, and rhubarb tends to go through a dormant period in the summer, after which the leaf stalks tend to not be particularly edible. So it's much better, particularly since the plant is a young plant as well, to let it rest after you've taken that flower spike out of it, and to allow the crown to build up to produce leaves that can be harvested again in the following spring.
Katie Singer from Chelmsford wants to know what plants grow in very clayish soil. So good plants for clayish soil in the dry county of Essex.
I suppose my first comment would be to try and improve it in some way, and that way would be to add and incorporate organic matter, so well-rotted farmyard manure if you can get hold of it, garden compost if you make your own, that's very good as well. A lot of people say, can I put grit in there? They say, can I put lots of horticultural grit in there? Well, potentially yes, you could. The principle sounds good, but the amount that you would need would be so much. It would be about 50% native soil to 50% grit, which is really quite impractical for most people. And it would probably disperse after a while and you would lose the effect of it. So we tend to say use organic matter instead. And it's something that will gradually build up over the years. So that would be the first thing to do. And then beyond that, I mean, clay is a very nutritious soil, so the range ought to be fairly broad once you get some drainage in by improving the soil structure, which is by adding organic matter. You'll know if farmyard manure is well rotted because it shouldn't smell of anything and it shouldn't be too identifiable as lumps of manure. I think those are probably the two. They shouldn't smell strong, it shouldn't smell of anything really, and it should be fairly crumbly. Garden centres sell soil conditioners which may have stable manure or farmyard manure in it. More likely the garden centres will be selling recycled landscape waste as a soil improver, which is okay as well, that's good as well. It can be quite alkaline, but it's a good product to put on to improve soil structure. And that's probably going to be more widely available than farmyard manures. It just depends on the garden centre. There are companies that bag it up and sell farmyard manure, but it depends perhaps where you are in the country.
I always think with clay soils, the best things are trees, shrubs and climbers, because the clay is sticky old stuff and it's difficult to sow seeds and put out plants in the spring. Herbaceous plants don't seem to do as well as they would in a lighter soil. And bulbs do very well. Narcissi, snowdrops in particular, do very well in a clayish soil. So the kind of shrubs that seem to do well on the clay soil, and the shrubs are usually the basis of most gardens, are things like viburnums, mahonias, and berberis. Abelia seems to do particularly well, and hedges grow very well. So hedges are things like hornbeam and yew are particularly attractive on a clayish soil. This isn't so much a problem in Essex, but more in wetter areas, is that the clay soil can get very wet, and so trees and shrubs can rot out if it's wet. So in those sort of areas, do what our gardeners do in Rosemore and Devon, which is plant on a bit of a mound, and that keeps the base of the plant a little bit drier than if it was sitting in soggy clay. And if you want to see what grows very well in your area in Chelmsford, the Royal Horticultural Society garden at Hyde Hall is very close and has a wide range of plants growing in the clay soil.
Remember, RHS members can contact our advice team by phone, email or letter for free help with any gardening queries. If you'd like details on how you can become a member of the RHS, just go to rhs.org.uk/join. The advice team also run drop-in surgeries at RHS plant and flower shows, where any show visitor can come and ask their gardening questions. So if you're visiting the RHS Flower Show Birmingham at BBC Gardeners World Live, 12th to the 15th of June, or any of our summer flower shows around the UK, why not come and talk to the advisors about your garden problems? I'm Sian Thomas, and you're listening to the RHS Gardening Podcast. Now to the perennial problem of border control. Whether your garden has raised beds, multiple borders, or a single border display, deciding what to plant and managing the design as the plants mature can be tricky. At RHS Garden Wisley, you can find inspiration for your own beds in the vast variety of ornamental displays. Here's garden manager Matthew Pottage again with some suggestions of how you can choose plants to get borders with a real wow factor.
So now is a time of year when we've seen Chelsea, all the plants are waking up around us, gardens full of colour, and it's often the time when we get inspired, we go to the garden centre and we do a load of impulse buying, which is good fun, and it's great, it supports our nursery industry. But one thing I urge you just to think about is a theme. It sounds cheesy, theming a border, and maybe you don't want to have, you know, a very tight theme, but just some kind of colour scheme, texture, some kind of order to the bed. It can make such a difference just to pause and think, actually, what are the colours around me? What would be in keeping? How much sun and light does the border get? If you've got a blazing hot border in full sun, to go with really rich, colourful oranges and reds, they look brilliant. Put them in a shaded border, they look washed out, they can look a bit miserable. But bring blues and silvers and whites to a shady border, it lights it up. You know, what is the backdrop? Have you got a dark wall, a dark hedge? Is it completely open? Is it completely sunny? And if you've got some traditional planting already nearby, say you've got some old holly trees or a yew hedge, or you've got something that looks quite formal, going and putting blousy bedding plants, bananas, cannas, may not always work. So just think, what's around? What do you have? And how much light does it get? And just spend some time, maybe look up something your neighbours have done. There's often times when someone, say, uses white gravel or a golden conifer or a very purple leaf plant, and you think, really, it just doesn't work. So what is really good is maybe picking up a few things from a garden centre, standing them around in the beds, see what they work with, see what they don't. Come to somewhere like Wisley and have a look around for inspiration. But just please, I urge you, just to give a bit of thought to colours and textures and your location, what you think could work in your location. And it really will help you bring a longer term enjoyment. And you won't look at it in 18 months' time and think, oh, what's working here? What's wrong? What's catching my eye? And what didn't we quite grasp with this? And it makes such a difference in the long run for the enjoyment of your garden. Other things to remember when you're planting your scheme, when you're planning your border, is do think of eventual heights. Think of growing speeds, how quick things grow. Sometimes you can save yourself money because things knit together very quickly. Sometimes if you've got a shrub and you know it's going to be slow growing and actually you want to plant three and let them grow into each other, that's absolutely fine. Things can grow together as one. But with some herbaceous plants, with, you know, things that you'd use at the front of a border traditionally, things can knit together quickly. Or look at the plant in the garden centre and think, you know, there's quite a lot there in the pot. I could divide it after the first year. But don't overplant, because sometimes things can look so congested and you don't always get the best from the plants. And also just remember, when you're placing things out, it can be really nice to contrast foliage. So if you've got a broad leaf, you put a fern next to it, you put a grass next to it, you put a narrow leaf next to something with a much wider leaf. And it just helps to set things off. Sometimes if you've got a lot of samey things in one space, you lose them, they blend into each other. So do just think, actually, if you're putting a broad leaf there or a dark leaf there, do I want a lighter leaf next to it? And it just helps plants show each other off to their best potential.
Matthew Pottage, garden manager at RHS Garden Wisley in Surrey. You can find more information on the plants discussed, as well as guides to garden design, on our website, rhs.org.uk. On the website, you can also find details of shows, events and activities happening in our four RHS gardens. Coming up soon, celebrate Father's Day with the family at all four RHS gardens on the weekend, 14th to the 15th of June. At Harlow Carr, go on an orienteering course with Dad. At Rosemore, follow self-guided trails. At Hyde Hall, grab a great lunch at the Barn Restaurant. And at Wisley, meet some garden tribes. Enjoy the summer solstice at RHS Garden Rosemore on the weekend of 21st to the 22nd of June with its special Rose Weekend. Experts will be on hand to offer rose advice. There'll be rose identification opportunities and free guided walks around Rosemore's stunning rose gardens. What's more, there'll be a talk by David Austin Roses at 12 noon on Saturday. On 25th of June, come along to RHS Garden Harlow Carr for an introduction to using medicinal herbs at home. from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Find out how to make your own herbal remedies for everyday ailments using plants from your garden and the hedgerow with medical herbalist Belle Charlesworth. Tea, coffee and workshop materials are included. Come to RHS Garden Hyde Hall on the 26th of June from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and learn everything you need to know about dry gardens with a workshop on creating a dry garden, from creating and selecting suitable plants to maintenance and aftercare. This workshop will also include a comprehensive guided tour of the Hyde Hall Dry Garden. For more information on these and all RHS events, go to rhs.org.uk/gardens and select What's On. At the recent RHS Chelsea Flower Show, we asked gardening legend Alan Titchmarsh what were his favourite RHS gardens to visit.
I love going round the RHS gardens for the breadth of plant material, and I'll see something different every time. It's often a little corner. The gardens I like best in life are those made by individuals, because you see heart and soul. The great thing about the RHS gardens is you see outreach. You see things going on which will capture imagination, either a well-grown tree. I've always loved, and it's absolutely massive, the rock garden at Wisley, because it's vast. And I come from the moors, you know, the Yorkshire moors, Ilkley Moor. And I look at the rock garden, oh, I'd love one of those. And the things, and water I love, and to watch streams running through a rock garden. So things, I love Rosemore in Devon, but the garden, of course, I've got to pin my hat on, really, is Harlow Carr, because it's literally about 15 miles from where I grew up. And we used to go to Harlow Carr a lot in the days when Geoffrey Smith, who was a lovely old chap, was the sort of curator there, and I knew Geoffrey, and he's a splendid guy. And I remember the first time I ever saw him, because I used to see him on television as a lad when I was an apprentice, and he used to be on Look North doing gardening. And I went to Harlow Carr, and it's about the first time I'd been there, and I turned around, and he was standing on top of the rock garden in his boots, and he looked like a god.
Alan Titchmarsh. We're out of time on this edition of the RHS Gardening Podcast, sponsored by Visit Wales. We'll be back in a fortnight. Until then, remember to follow us on Twitter at @the_RHS and like us on Facebook. For now, from me, Sian Thomas, and all the podcast team, goodbye.